A short time ago, the sheriff here confirmed that there was a relationship between the church behind me and the shooter. We are told now that the parents of the shooter's ex-wife worshiped here. They were not at church yesterday, but they do worship at First Baptist Church. We also learned a short time ago that between 12 and 14 of the dead are children. 8 of those killed from the same family.
He would choke me, punch me, kick me. There would be times where I would be on the floor, curled up, and having to protect my organs because he would be violently kicking me on my side. Like I was less of a person is how it made me feel. I remember I contacted my sister and let her, know what happened. And security forces, which is the equivalent of like the police for the Air Force. He told me, if you do this, if you tell them, I'm gonna kill you and your entire family.
So he threatened to kill you and your whole family?
Yeah.
Did you believe him?
I didn't take it lightly.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and also author of The Dash Risk Model and the book Policing Domestic Violence. And today I'm back in LA, back in the studio, and I'm with...
Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
And also with us today is a very special guest.
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes. I'm a former state and federal prosecutor and co-host of the podcast Best Case, Worst Case with your own Jim Clementi, who I guess I'm kind of subbing in for, if one can actually sub in.
I don't think that's possible. There's no substitute for the Clementi, but he is traveling right now as we speak. And so we're so glad that Francie could join us and jump on in. She's part of our family anyway. So it makes perfect sense that she's here.
Exactly. Happy to be here. We're really pleased to have you, Francie. And I'm definitely pleased to be back in the LA studio as well. So no Skype. Hopefully the sound quality is good. And we want to talk about a subject that's very dear to all of our hearts, and we've been sort of discussing this quite a lot behind the scenes, and I know that there's been a lot of people with a lot to say on the subject, but it's important that we also hear from experts on a subject like this, and many of you will have been aware, because it's been all over the international news headlines, about the horrific mass shooting that happened in Texas on November the 5th, in fact, a week ago today. And today that we record it. And it's such a horrific situation where you hear about one particular individual who made a very clear, premeditated, controlled and methodical plan to take the lives of so many people within a captive environment and a target-rich environment. And those people who were in the church in Texas praying were effectively sitting ducks, which makes it somehow even worse, the place that where they were. But certainly, sadly, how many people lost their lives on that day. And in fact, there were 25 people and there was an unborn child. And we really want to start off by paying tribute, as everybody who knows Real Crime Profile knows that we put the victims at the centre of everything that we do. And I know it's something that Francie holds dear as well. And we want to start off with telling you a little bit about some of the people who died so that we memorialise them. And at no point throughout what we're going to be discussing today will we mention the gunman's name. We will not be memorialising that individual, but we will be talking about some of the psychological aspects and the behavioural components, and also what were some of the warning signs and how potentially this could have been prevented. So, what we now know about Texas, well, sadly, many of the victims who were in the church had known each other for many years. And I guess that's really no surprise, is it, when we think about the small town like Sutherland Springs of, basically they're people who have been in the community for a very long time and generations of families. And so here's what we know about some of the people who died. Sarah and Dennis Johnson were among those who were shot dead. And Dennis was 77 years of age and he was with his wife, who was 68. And they'd been members of the First Baptist and died in the shooting, along with Katie Wall, one of their 6 children.
Also killed was grandmother Lula White, She was 71 and a church volunteer. And I should say, being from the South myself, I'm very familiar with how much social happens at a church. Lots of things, especially in these small towns, happen around church. Everyone knows everyone. They go to church together, but they do all sorts of other things together. You know, there's often these Wednesday night potluck dinners. So these people are more than just sitting in a church praying together. They're really much more like an extended family. And it adds to the tragedy, I think, in this case.
Another victim was Annabelle Pomeroy. So she was the 14-year-old daughter of Sherry and Frank Pomeroy, the church's regular pastor who was traveling when the shooting occurred. And I just can't imagine hearing that news that your daughter, who is supposed to be safe and sound back at home, and who I know whenever my husband and I are traveling, we always tell our kids, you know, mommy and dad will be back, you know, we'll be back. And you know, there's no reason to worry. There's no reason to be afraid. You're in good hands. And to know that this happened while they were away is just truly heartbreaking.
It really is. Along with Haley Kruger, who was 16 years of age, she had actually helped in the church that morning, putting together the breakfast. She apparently wanted to go on to have a career as a nurse, and because she loved babies so much. And her mum said that she was a 16-year-old just full of vibrancy and full of the zest for life.
Well, and in what is certainly a tragedy within a tragedy, 8 members of one family were killed by this murderous, horrible, evil person, the Holcomb family. Brian Holcomb was 60. Danny Holcomb, 36, Brian and Carla's son, Noah, Danny's 17-month-old daughter, just probably walking and talking, was killed. The pregnant wife of Brian and Carla's other son, John, who survived the shooting. Also killed were 3 of Crystal Holcomb's 5 children. Emily was 11, Megan was 9, and Greg Hill was 13. Tara Elise McNulty, a close friend of the family, also died. I cannot imagine the agony that this family is going through, and my heart goes out to them. One of the things we'll talk about, I'm sure, later is the targeting of the children. Of course, having been a Crimes Against Children prosecutor, any crime involving a child is very near and dear to my heart and close to my heart. And to hear that he was targeting children in particular who were crying is, like you said, heartbreaking.
There was also Teresa and Richard Rodriguez. They had been married for 11 years, longtime members of the church. They'd often bring their grandchildren with them to the church. I guess, fortunately, on this day, they were not with them. And their daughter, Regina, says that her father was country. And I just love that, you know. And he's wearing his big old cowboy hat and his jeans and very clearly loved her dad very much.
Robert and Shani Corrigan, well, they were originally from Michigan, but they were childhood sweethearts when they got together. And it's incredibly sad that they moved there, and actually they lost their son, Forrest, the year before. And they too were killed tragically in this murderous event.
And in another horrible account of a family being killed, Joanne Ward, daughters Brooke Ward, who was 5, and Emily Garza, only 7, were killed in the shooting as well. And Joanne leaves behind her husband, Chris Ward, and 2 surviving children, Ryland and Rihanna. Ryland was hospitalized after the attack, having been shot several times, and we certainly hope Ryland makes a full recovery.
Also lost were Robert Scott Marshall and his wife, Karen. Now, they had recently moved to Texas, and they were attending the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs for the very first time.
Peggy Lynn Warden, she was 56, and her sister's testament to her said that she was the foundation to their family, and she always loved to help other people.
Keith Allen Braden was lost. His brother Bruce talks specifically about how his family attended the church regularly and how Keith worked in a local grocery store and has left behind a wife and 6-year-old granddaughter mourning him.
So these are just some of the victims who were murdered on that day. I think it's important to say that at the time of the event, some of the newspapers reported that this was an individual who was full of anger and rage, which gave a certain understanding of who this might be. But actually, this was somebody who went into that church with a very cold and clinical and methodical plan of what he was going to do. And I think we've certainly been seeing now more of these particular mass shootings, you know, one following the other, but certainly in what we would call a very target-rich environment where people are contained and literally are sitting ducks. And that tells me something very much about the psychology of this particular type of individual. And we are going to get into the detail of that, but certainly it tells me, firstly, that this is somebody who really wants to have a very high body count, and that it's very personal in terms of the particular church that he's chosen. And of course, we now understand a little bit more about the background of this gunman, and that there was a very clear history of domestic violence, but not just domestic violence, it's coercive control. And some may refer to it as intimate partner terrorism, but it's the same as coercive control. And we also learn that he had a background of stalking and child abuse. And I think the child abuse side, certainly from reading a lot in France, you already mentioned the fact that he targeted children in particular, but we learned that his ex-wife, she in particular gave an account of where he beat the child, his son, so badly that he fractured his skull and he almost died in that particular incident.
As a toddler too.
As a small child, that's exactly right. And I've tried child homicide cases as a state prosecutor. And so I'm well aware of all the forensics. And just so Real Crime Profile listeners are aware, medical professionals told me when I was preparing one particular case that involved a child who had a fractured skull and was killed by his mother's boyfriend, that it's actually quite difficult to fracture a child's skull, a child that age. The skull is not the same as it is when we're adults. You know, we're much more sort of eggshellish as adults, and it's much easier to fracture our skulls. But children, until they reach a really advanced age in childhood, 6, 8, 10 years old, the skull is still a bit rubbery and pliable, and that's on purpose because it gives everything room to grow and room to expand. And so for this man to have fractured a child's skull while abusing him means that the abuse itself was very violent and very serious. And I think that it is really insight into him as a person and the fact that he is willing and cold and calm about perpetrating violence on those he most cares about or is most supposed to care about, much less strangers in a church.
Right. And this is where exactly that link needs to be made. And I think far too often people think about, well, domestic violence is just something that happens to significant people around the perpetrator. And I say just in inverted commas, because actually the basic premise is if you are prepared to hurt and injure and torture and psychologically abuse and sometimes sexually abuse the person you're meant to or people you're meant to love and care for the most, what are you prepared to do to people that you don't know and you don't care about? So here we have the classic, unfortunately, link again. These cases don't just happen out the blue. And I think it's really important that our listeners do and professionals really do understand that. There are normally many warning signs. And this case, sadly, is no different. So fracturing his child's skull to such a degree that it was likely to produce death or grievous bodily harm. This was when he was in the Air Force. And I think what's very interesting is that he had multiple relationships and each partner said very similar things about him. But the Air Force in particular as a workplace, I think the questions have to be asked about how that particular incident was dealt with. Because actually, Francie, that he was given 12 months in a military prison for that. What do you make of that?
He was. And of course, in regular court here in the U.S., that's considered a misdemeanor. 12 months or less is defined, generally speaking, as a misdemeanor rather than a felony. Anything over 12 months is a felony. And I think it's an incredibly insufficient sentence, but it really shows, I think, where our society still is when it comes to protecting women and children. What is it about those who abuse those closest to them getting lighter sentences than if a stranger had come into the house in some sort of home invasion and committed exactly the same offenses against that woman and her child, I can virtually guarantee you would have spent a lot more time in prison than 12 months. He would have been called a monster and evil, and the book would have been thrown at him. And yet here we have the man supposed to protect his wife and child and is the one instead abusing them so grievously. I think it's a shocking lack of seriousness on the part of the Air Force. I'd like to say that courts everywhere else in the country treat it better, but that's just sadly not true. I mean, I've prosecuted domestic violence cases as a baby prosecutor, and domestic violence is a misdemeanor in almost every state in this country. So no one's going to spend any significant amount of jail time if they commit domestic violence battery, for example.
Now tonight, in a town where hardly anyone locks their doors, the questions: why did this happen? How do they move on?
Our community is a very humble community. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, you know, the best or anything. It's just everybody helps each other. Everybody. You know, it's devastating.
So this shooter targeted surrogates, it seems like, or the person he was really angry with. Am I getting that right? That he was really angry with his ex-wife and he took it out on her family and him in blazing at this church? I mean, she wasn't there.
No, I understand that he was targeting his mother-in-law. So, yes, mm-hmm. his wife's family, that he wanted to, you know, say to them, you can't, whatever they're doing to him, you can't do that to me. You can't disrespect me. You can't ignore me. I will show you who's boss. I will show you who's in charge. And so from what we understand so far anyway, he targeted that church because that is where his mother-in-law and the family went to church. And it's likely that he expected to find her there. And whether he found her there or not was irrelevant to his ultimate plan. He was going to kill people to exert that sort of his own view of who he was. He's in charge. He decides who lives and who dies. It's what Jim Clementi would call having a God complex, like the sniper in the Vegas killings, having a God complex, being the one to decide who lives and who dies.
Well, this is actually much more about his just everyday life, and it's about power and control. And the dynamic, this is why it's so important that people understand this dynamic of power and control, because when you have people who want to be an authority figure, and we know from the Orlando case, the Pulse nightclub, he wanted to join the police force. He had an authority figure complex of wanting to be in power. And most domestic violence and domestic abusers, that's exactly what they're after, to have power and control over the other people around them. And here we have another individual who's incredibly entitled, and everybody who came across him in their day-to-day interactions said as much, to the point that even as a security guard, he would just be plain mean, he was described as miserable and horrible and just micromanaging. And you'd probably describe him as a Jobsworth, you know, one of these people who takes a lot of pleasure at controlling people's day-to-day behaviour without any real need to. And he was the same with the women in his life, the same with the children. And so this is an extension of that. And, you know, what we know about domestic violence offenders is that when they are, or when there's been separation and there's been coercive control, the same behaviours can then become stalking. And if they make a threat to kill or to harm, one in two of them will act on that threat. Now, what we do know is that he threatened the mother-in-law. And I believe he had an ongoing set of issues, which probably all come down to the separation points with his ex. And there were text messages back and forth where he had made a threat to kill. And the nuanced detail of those threats is always something, as a criminal behavioral analyst, that's what I'm very much interested in. What was being said? How? Why? What was the context to it? That insight would tell us a lot more about those trigger factors. But of course, this guy is like a tinderbox anyway. He has so many grievances of people doing wrong, and to him, he would see himself as the victim. And yes, as you say, Francie, it was absolutely about a grievance and grudge-related behaviour. It was about power and control and feeling very entitled. And that's what we tend to see of mass shooters. You know, there's a grudge related behavior where they want to exact revenge. And there's no coincidence of his ties to that church and his ex's family ties to that church as well. Perhaps he did think that they would all be in there. Who knows? But he certainly chose the target-rich environment. And having been out with them, I think it was at Halloween where he'd gone to a party and people said he was acting very strangely, dressed in black kind of fatigues, and that he was kind of had the smirk de triomphe of kind of, I know something you don't know. And that, for me, that kind of leakage about his personality, it tells us that he has probably already got the idea in his head about what he's going to do, and he's feeling that kind of power and control and omnipotence that kind of gives him an air that he is in control of everything that's about to unfold. And I believe he did say something like, as the doors open, you're all going to die. He wanted to see their reaction of him being the utmost powerful force in there about to unleash, sadly, a deadly weapon at very close range, and specifically pointing it at the children when they cried. So I think this kind of coercive control behaviour, people really don't understand that micromanagement and that need to always be dominant and be the one that is in control of everything. And so anybody's challenge to that authority is seen as a slight and a grievance. And it's almost like accumulated grievances that build up. But where those key triggers are, I mean, it'd be very, very interesting to hear more from law enforcement as they piece it together about what those triggers were. And of course, the triggers aren't an excuse. But for someone like him, you know, he's a walking time bomb, ostensibly. And from every partner, they say the same things about him. For me, it just keeps going back to the point, why do we not take domestic abuse and domestic violence seriously? Why do we not understand that these cases with stalking are the most dangerous of cases? And to your point, Francie, I totally agree. The same crimes that are carried out on strangers or other people that are not significant, you would expect to see a far longer sentence in a court. But it's the people that, with the trust and the relationship, it's, and the more serious levels of post-traumatic stress. And of course, we know 3 women are murdered every day in America at the hands of their partners. We also know that 47 women are murdered and the individual, the perpetrator, turns the weapon on themselves. We call them murder suicides. 47 every month in the US. The rate of women and children being killed in domestic violence situations, if those cases were happening in one place at the same time, it would be a far greater body count than these mass shootings. And so it really is time that people joined up, that these very dangerous men need to be properly understood. And when a victim reports domestic violence and child abuse, people and professionals must take that very seriously. And that's why the DASH risk assessment model is such an important part of the process of asking the right questions and taking these crimes very seriously. And unfortunately, the Air Force did not do that. And, you know, he was somebody who had served his 12 months, but then, of course, he did leave the Air Force.
He was dishonorably discharged.
Yes, yeah, so he was released from the Air Force with a bad conduct discharge rather than a dishonorable discharge. And apparently it's the dishonorable discharge which would have meant that it would have been an automatic loss of all veteran benefits and privileges, and that he wouldn't have been able to then get a weapon. But these gaps and these loopholes, because the Air Force didn't see it as something as serious. And of course, we see this every day currently, not just the Air Force, but law enforcement and all professionals still with this notion of, well, it's just a domestic.
It wasn't that long ago that in this country, you had to have the cooperation of usually the spouse, the wife. You had to have the cooperation of the wife in order to pursue domestic violence charges. And if, as they typically do, she recanted, any prosecution and charges were simply dropped. Then there was at least some education, some understanding of the dynamics of domestic abuse, and those laws were changed so that prosecutors and police no longer need the cooperation of the victim. They can instead use what the victim said when they first report, take photographs of the injuries, and even if the victim refuses to cooperate after that, they can still prosecute the cases. So at least we've made a small step forward when it comes to taking these kinds of cases seriously. But as you say, Laura, they're still not taken seriously. It's like child abuse. I always say that children have no lobby, no voice, no money, no power. And so I don't think that the state, local, and federal governments treat child sexual abuse, child pornography offenses as seriously as they should, because those kids aren't voting. And so they just don't devote the resources, the time, the attention to them that is required to actually do something about the problem.
And of course, we give them a voice. And I have to say, in the UK, we actually have victimless prosecutions. You know, and the whole sea change came in. There were a bunch of us who were all saying, well, with a murder victim, you know, when a murder happens, you don't rely on the victim to give evidence. And so we train, and I'm one of those professionals who train police officers and Crown Prosecution Service and judges and magistrates about all the different ways that you can bring a prosecution without the victim, because most oftentimes the victims are in fear, and that's all part and parcel of coercive control. So the sea change is taking, you know, a very long time, but the evidence is there more often than not. If you ask the right questions, if you take pictures, I mean, our police now have body-worn cameras. So when they attend a scene, a 999 call, everything is being shown on camera as to what they, you know, what they saw as soon as they went through the door, both from the victim's reaction to the perpetrator. And I think that that's just so important, that evidence is collected. But the biggest challenge, actually, what I've been saying now for a number of years, is that it's about believing victims. You know, and if you don't believe someone, then you're not going to take any action, and you will be much more likely to dismiss them. So it's about the attitude, firstly, and aptitude. But I think it's really about leadership, you know, and if the top level of brass and officers or officials say that this is something that's important, and if people are measured and monitored on it because it's an important thing politically, then much more is done. And that's not rocket science. But I just, you know, so frustrated, and I get so upset with looking at families in the white of their eyes when they've lost somebody. And it's just the same lessons coming out time and time again. And to me, this particular case, when we think about this in the context of San Bernardino, Karen Smith, who was shot dead in her school this year in April, and one of her students who was killed, well, he went to that school to target her. And of course, it was reported as a school shooting, but it was actually a domestic violence stalking case again. So the narrative can get shifted out of what it really is. And I think that's where it's important that we make these links. And it's not just about domestic violence per se, because there is a component of domestic violence and abuse that's called coercive control. And they're the cases that correlate with lethality, and where you can have someone, if they are at a point where there is, in their eyes, finality, i.e. they're at the end of the road with wherever they are in their life situation and whatever those triggers might be. So if you have finality, if you have a revenge motive, if you have last resort thinking, where you hear through what someone's saying, if I can't have you, no one can, or you're not going to get away with doing this to me, I'm going to make you pay, bitch, I'm going to make you suffer for what you've done. So these kinds of statements, along with entitlement and escalation and coercive control and stalking, and you add in threats to kill, the one in two who make a threat will act on it, these are very clear risk markers. And this case had pretty much all of them. So, you know, my plea is to the professionals, to the authorities, to invest in training their staff properly, so that when we hear victims and families coming to the charities, to the police, to other professionals, to health, to social services, in the UK in particular, they should ask the right questions about what's happening, because these cases do not come out the blue. And in fact, you know, there's been some research, hasn't there,
yes,
that
shows that from 2009 to 2016, there's been 156 mass shootings here in the US. I mean, that's staggering, isn't it, Francie? 156, with 848 people being killed, 339 murdered, 54% of them being domestic violence related, and 42% where there are very clear warning signs, all of which I've just described.
Everybody was so quiet, you could only hear the sound of the bullets. And people screaming and people crying, and mama, where are you, mama, the little kids.
Was anybody trying to get away? Was there anywhere to go?
No, there was nowhere to go.
You were all trapped.
You were trapped inside.
It is, you know, I think the hardest thing about warning signs, and I have to sort of drawback as the prosecutor voice at the table. I drive Jim crazy when I do this on our podcast. It's, you know, warning signs certainly should be noted. But the problem is that warning signs are rarely illegal. And so when someone exhibits signs that the police can't necessarily do anything about, how can they stop the person? I mean, that's the fundamental problem, I think, that we don't understand. We have to understand better the dynamics of domestic violence. We have to understand better triggers and who might be lethal and who might not. But it's just like when you're looking at child abuse cases. For example, take child pornography, which is at an epidemic proportions, especially because of the advent of the internet. Police around the world are desperately trying to figure out, because they can literally find thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who right this minute are trafficking in the images of child sexual abuse. They know where they are, but they don't have the resources to go and get them. There aren't enough police in any country, any community. So they're all trying to figure out, so who's the most dangerous? Which ones of those do we actually prioritize? And no one can really say that yet. There's a lot of research going on about it, but the answers just aren't there.
But they are with domestic violence, Francie. I mean, I'm one of the key researchers that has produced that research body. And so with the DASH, have you seen the DASH?
I have.
Risk Identification Assessment and Management Model. We have a set of 27 questions that law enforcement ask of victims. And those questions are derived through research. So we have a set of high risk factors, some of which I've just mentioned. And some of them are critical risk considerations. I've now been building on the research, and they are things like separation. It's the heightened risk when somebody leaves. That's the most dangerous time. And we know 76% of the murders happen on separation, 34% in the first month, 80% within the first 4 months. So this narrows the filter. You know, if you ask the right questions of victims, if there's coercive control, and we have a set of questions for that, on separation, the same behaviour as stalking. And stalking correlates highly with murder, as does coercive control. And in fact, in the UK, murders that were analysed by Gloucestershire University, they found 94% of the murders had coercive control and stalking in it. And that's why, again, we are specifically about those behaviours.
But if you try to sort of reverse engineer and say that you have these risk factors present, and someone said, if I can't have you, nobody can, that's not illegal. You can't put that guy in custody for that. Of course you can if he's beat the woman. Absolutely.
You can in the UK.
But they don't. But they don't get put away. I'm sorry.
You're absolutely right. They don't. That's my point.
Yeah.
And in the U.S., telling someone if I can't have you, no one will, is not a crime. And so you can't put that person in jail for making that kind of statement. And we don't have enough police officers to go and protect those women, or enough shelters for those women to go for what period of time until he cools off. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, they're two separate things.
It's a very complex problem.
US is one context, but I can certainly say in the UK, and if I can just mention that first, coercive control is a crime. And so it became a crime in December 2015. So if there's coercively controlling behaviour, and we're training all of our police on it, that individual can be arrested and can be put before the courts for it. It's a maximum sentence of 5 years, and the sentencing guidelines are just being written. Stalking is also a crime. So those behaviours, and having been the person who championed and spearheaded both those campaigns and sat writing the legislation with the lawyers from the Home Office and with a group of other experts, there's a very clear set of behaviours that when you ask a victim what's happening, that clear points to prove that you can show within the court of law. And stalking now carries up to 10 years. And we do have a threats to kill offence too that also carries up to 10 years. And you can lay multiple charges. Now, you know, I understand you're talking about the US in particular, but again, the same risk markers, you know, I mean, stalking is a crime here in California and in most states. And I'm really keen to start momentum around the coercive control offence. Because I do understand what you're saying, and it was one of the problems that we had in the UK, is that unless somebody is physically violent, where is the crime? If it's psychological and if it's coercive control, because the 999 call will happen, and here the 911, police go out and they attend the incident and they look for the physical evidence. However, if it's coercive control and there isn't anything physical, and they're not asking about the pattern, then they miss a lot about what's going on. So I think there is a gap in the law here, But the risk markers are very similar, and I mean high risk factors. And a lot of academics and professionals, people like Gavin De Becker, have worked really hard on, you know, sadly having to review many, many cases to find those common denominators. And far too often, those risk factors are very clear, and multiple victims have reported that individual. And I think that's to another point about serial perpetrators, because many of them, if there isn't an effective intervention, then guess what happens? And we all know they just carry on doing the same thing with the next victim, the next victim, the next victim. So the serial perpetrator piece is really important, that questions are asked about the offender. And of course, we talked about Dirty John. I don't know whether you heard that podcast, but his behaviour to multiple women. And again, you know, you can use similar fact, bad character. But all these things, you have to use the, you know, the research and the risk tools that are available. And of course, professionals do need training on that. So it's not simple that you can just pick a tool up and just use it. But I think far too often, because people think, well, it's just a domestic, you know, it's not anything that's serious. It was just an argument, or, you know, so what? Nothing much really happened, or it's just behind closed doors. And actually, I don't want to intervene. That is the first stumbling block, I think, and people not making the links between domestic violence, stalking and mass shootings and terrorist events, where we also see, you know, like the Marathon bomber, he had a history of domestic abuse and domestic violence. And it's how you treat the people in your immediate perimeter tells you a lot about someone's psychology.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that society misapprehends, because they do think it is something that takes place behind closed doors. And of course, in this country, we do have laws against abuse, physical abuse. We have laws against stalking. We all also have laws against threatening to kill someone, but that threat has to be a clear threat to kill. It can't be something vague, because of the First Amendment. We have a right to, you have a right to say horrible things about people, but you don't have a right to threaten to kill someone. And so while we have those laws, I think that what you're saying is exactly right. We just do not have an understanding, a fundamental understanding of the dynamics of domestic abuse, and more importantly, that domestic abuse can lead to sort of community abuse, if you will. And that's where I think we're really lacking, because you look at all these cases that you've named, clearly we're not connecting the dots.
Absolutely. And I'm not an academic nor a professional. You know, I'm just a woman who is absolutely terrified by the things that I'm seeing take place. And I'm looking at this statistic, Laura, and Francie, maybe you know about it, the FBI data on mass shootings from 2009 to 2015, 57% of the cases of these mass shooters included a spouse, former spouse, or other family member among the victims. And 16% of these attackers had previously been charged with DV, with domestic violence.
Right.
So they're learning it doesn't matter if they're being charged with domestic violence, because they have basically no...
But they can offend with impunity.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the problem. They get away with it. And in fact, one of my reports I published in 2004 was called Getting Away With It. And it was an analysis of 450 offenders that the Metropolitan Police Service, it was when I was working at New Scotland Yard, had arrested for domestic violence. And actually, only two of them ended up being charged. And that's why I called it Getting Away With It. It was actually a title that was given to the research by the Detective Chief Inspector Simon Letchford. But it really just showed that, you know, if you keep getting away with things and you just carry on doing what you've always done, because it gets you what you want, and then you see escalation and you see terrible things then happen, things escalate to serious harm and murder. And that's really where I started my body of research. And it's a real challenge when a criminal justice system behaves like a bad parent.
Well, and in most jurisdictions, someone's, quote, first offense for domestic violence, because it's so generally a misdemeanor, they're offered the option of going through anger management.
Which is ridiculous.
In lieu of prosecution. And so that just shows, as you've been saying, it isn't about anger management. It's about controlling someone else and having power. And so maybe we should be having classes about power and control management, not anger management.
Well, that's what Duluth, Minnesota started. And, you know, they created and developed the power and control wheel. And if you Google it, you can look it up online. But they have lots of different power and control wheels for, say, for example, police officers who are perpetrating domestic violence and abuse, or specific communities when you have so-called honor-based abuse as well. And we do have a lot of perpetrator programs in the UK now, and some of them are showing some good results. But it really is about that entitlement aspect. You know, these individuals who feel incredibly entitled, and it's not about anger management and anger or rage, which is how this particular shooting event was first described. But the point is, this is about perpetrators. In their minds, it's them taking control. It's not them losing control. They are back in control as they see it, because they're the ones dictating everything that then unfolds. And of course, they're leaving a legacy that they believe is a very powerful legacy. And that's why I believe they're trying to up the body count each time, because they're trying to get the next, you know, it's a horrific thing to say, but go down in the history books as, you know, a big name, because actually in their real life, they're very small and pathetic individuals.
I wanted to mention the Orlando shooter for 1 second, because this was certainly true. He had a marriage to a woman named Satora, and she says that he forced her to hand over her paychecks, forbade her to leave the house except to go to work, prevented her from contacting her parents. Small infractions were met with a violent response. He would beat her because the laundry wasn't finished, and on and on and on. It just follows the same pattern that you're talking about.
It does. And I think, you know, one of the things that especially the listeners of our Best Case, Worst Case pod know about me is that I do not believe in this country we have an over-incarceration problem. Mm. I believe we have an under-incarceration problem. People like this, who beat people, who abuse children, who assault others, they should be in prison, and they should stay there for a good long time in order to deter future criminal conduct. And I do think, like Laura, you talked a lot about research and intervention. I respect the people who want to intervene and try to train someone out of being a horrible abuser of their spouse. I think I'm fundamentally cynical, and I just don't think you can train
someone
out.
You mean you don't think they can change, Francie?
I don't. I absolutely do not. Therefore, to me, the one place they should be is in prison, behind bars where they can't hurt anybody else.
Well, you know, the one thing I've learned, and I've sat within perpetrator programs as just Laura the researcher, is that if the behavior doesn't get them what they want, i.e. what they're seeking to achieve, well, then guess what they do? They will change the behavior. They will switch it out. But it has to have a real life consequence. There has to be whatever is their biggest fear. That's what you have to work to, because guess what they're doing with the victims? They work on the victim's biggest fear and exploit all their vulnerabilities. So perpetrators, you know, it's police and those who are working on the programs with individuals, they have to understand their psychopathology. And quite frankly, some of them are psychopaths and some of them are not treatable. Others have personality disorders, but the entitlement and the narcissism of the kind of the me, myself and I being at the centre of it all, them claiming victimhood and transferring the lens, you know, that's what you do tend to see. And a small percentage of them, you know, we have seen some results with, but it's changing their sort of learning style. And really, they still put themselves at the centre of everything. Mm. But you have to switch out some of that behaviour that you might not get them to, you know, the other end of the continuum, but you might get them halfway there because it's in their own self-interest to change that behaviour.
Well, maybe it's my Southern upbringing, but I just think that there is right and wrong. It's a pretty black and white issue. And you don't have to teach someone that beating their spouse or abusing their child is wrong. And if someone is already doing it, I just don't believe you can teach them out of it. I think you can punish them out of it, maybe. But they already know they shouldn't beat their spouse. That's why it happens behind closed doors. They know they shouldn't abuse their child. It happens behind closed doors and not in front of witnesses. Only the truly insane commit those kind of crimes in front of a bunch of witnesses, for which they could report on them and go to jail. So I mean...
But it's not just about beating, though. I mean, I think we have to be very clear that a lot of it, coercive control, actually, in some of the cases I've worked, the perpetrator didn't even lift a hand, not once, in 22 years, never physically meted out any physical punishment. They didn't have to. They controlled the victim in every aspect of their life that they didn't need to raise a hand. And that's why it's really important to talk about that coercive control and that kind of intimate terrorism that we see that operates on fear and control, but not necessarily on the physical aspect.
We have had a small number of listeners contact us saying, you know what, the things that Laura talks about, I see in myself. How do I stop this jealousy and control? And, you know, our advice is get thee to a psychiatrist immediately. You know, and if you see that in yourself, then please seek out help to change those patterns and really address what's at the knuckle of it.
Okay.
Oh my God, you guys, we have so much more to talk about. We haven't even scratched the surface of all the things I want to ask you about. So I think we're going to continue this conversation next week, and Francie will be here with us. But before we go, we haven't done recommendations in quite a while. So I'd like to just pivot just a bit. And do you guys have anything you want to recommend? Podcasts, books, TV shows, documentaries?
Yeah, I'm going to weigh in with one, and our listeners will have seen it on Twitter, but there's one show in particular that I binged, and we definitely are going to discuss it on the podcast, and it's called Mindhunter.
Yes.
Love that show.
If you haven't seen it yet, check it out, because we will be discussing it, and certainly when we've got Jim back in the room. And, you know, again, when you watch it, just listen to what it's about the FBI, and it's about the behavioral units I actually was seconded to for some time, and our very own Jim Clemente worked there. And it's a very clever show because it charts sort of the history and the inception of the behavioral profiling units. But there's also a lot of cases that are threaded through each episode. But it's not with blood and gore and guts, and it's not sensationally done. But I think it's really interesting to listen to the backgrounds of those perpetrators, those serial killers,
yes,
because you will hear things within their backgrounds that talk to domestic violence and coercive control and abuse. So we can make the links in cases like that, the predatory stalkers and serial killers. And I think they've done a great job of the show with the music references and just the way it's been shot.
They have. I've been enjoying it myself. I've binged. I'm almost finished, so no spoilers, please. I would like to self-servingly tout the podcast that Jim Clemente and I have together, Best Case, Worst Case. Specifically, we have started a new feature called Worst Case Scenario. And on the podcast, we did a 3-episode version of that I called Power Position Predators. And one episode was about Harvey Weinstein and the Hollywood people. One was about this, what seems to be an epidemic of teachers, especially female teachers, abusing male students, mm-hmm, and how the media treats that so differently, mm-hmm, than if those gender roles were reversed. And then about the third was about the church and community offenders, the Catholic Church, things like Netflix, The Keepers. So I encourage people to tune in and see that. But I agree with Laura's recommendation. Netflix, The Mindhunter, is a fabulous series. I read John Douglas's book a long time ago.
Me too.
And it made a huge impression on me a long time ago. So,
yeah, I got to get caught up on that, you guys. I'm way behind. I have 2 things to recommend. One is an Amazon series called Tin Star. It stars Tim Roth as a fish out of water kind of sheriff. And it's a very violent, very bloody, gory murder mystery. But he's so wonderful that I had to keep watching. So I recommend Tin Star. And then I also want to recommend a show on CNN called This Is Life with Lisa Ling. Wow, what a wonderful series where she goes deep into all different kinds of communities. She goes into Las Vegas and the underground communities that are literally underneath the streets in Las Vegas. She goes into a community of polygamists. She goes into a Muslim community. She goes into all different kinds of communities that you never even knew were out there. And she goes really deep. So I recommend all 4 seasons of This Is Life with Lisa Ling.
And I've got one last really important recommendation before we sign off. At Paladin, we've had a production team following our work and 3 of our clients documenting their horrific ordeals and highlighting the risks and dangers of stalking and what happens when you report to police in the criminal justice system. Sadly, it's real life and it makes for very disturbing viewing. Stalkers will air on November the 20th on BBC One at 10:45 p.m. in the evening. So be sure to tune in and watch it, or you can watch it on BBC One iPlayer. And you can follow Paladin's Twitter account at Paladin Service for more information. So that's all we've got time for this week, but we'll be back next week with our special guest, Francie Hakes. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing off.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family, and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.